Okay, we are in Perek Lamed Ches, chapter 38, and up to Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. But in order to launch into this speech, the first of God's speeches, I wanted to revisit very briefly my point about Yov and Shir Hashirim, Job and Song of Songs, because I've had the chance to discuss it a lot with people over the last week and refined my thinking on it. And you know, as I said last week, to my mind, these books are really two sides of the same coin. And the coin is the search for a relationship with God. That's fundamentally what I see in both of them. In Shir Hashirim, in Song of Songs, it's a search for a loving relationship with God. It's about what we call in Hebrew ahava, in which the Jew is, you know, is portrayed as the woman in that story, and the king is God. But the search is for a loving relationship, and that's the way that they describe each other. God describes the Jews as his beloved. The Jews describe God as their beloved. Whereas in Iyov, in a Job, it's a relationship of yirah, a relationship of awe, reverence, and yes, fear between them, in which Iyov is never described. Job is never described as loving God. For all of the wonderful adjectives about Job in the beginning of the book, he is tam v'yashar yirei Elokim sar meira. He is complete. He doesn't sin. He is righteous. He is yirei Elokim, God revering or God fearing. He stays away from doing bad things. But not an ounce of love is described there. It's a book about a relationship of yirah, a relationship of reverence. And the parallels between the books come after that starting point, because you find the relationship break in each of them. In Shir Hashirim, in Song of Songs, the relationship breaks because God knocks at the door and we don't answer the door. In Job, the relationship breaks because God breaks the relationship. Because the relationship had been, Job does what he believes God wants him to do, and he wins prizes, and everything is nice, until suddenly, instead, he gets zapped, his household gets zapped, his estate gets zapped, and that's the disruption of the relationship. In both books, we go looking to rebuild it. In Song of Songs, we go out in the streets and go looking for God. In Job, Job says, I want God to talk to me. All I want is communication. If God doesn't restore me, that's fine. But at least let him explain what's going on. In both books, there are hostile outside parties. In Shir Hashirim, in Song of Songs, it's the guards as we circulate through the city looking for God. And they beat us up and they say, what is your God any different from any other? Why is your beloved any different from any other? And we then turn to them and describe our vision of God and why God is so wonderful. In Job, it's his visitors who are beating him up. And Job's response to the visitors is to say, you don't understand God at all. Let me tell you what God is really like. Including long expressions of praise for God. And then one of the key points that really only evolved in my thinking in the course of the past week, neither book really has a reunion. Neither book has a happy ending. Meaning, in Song of Songs, in Shir Hashirim, there isn't a clear reunion with God. After we go searching for God through the city, we don't get this wonderful happy ending, and it's a hard book in terms of figuring out where the ending is altogether. Does it have an ending? But we don't get a clear, yeah, a clear moment in which we have found God and everything is wonderful. And in Job, we don't get that either. Instead, what we find in Job is God saying to him, and those are the speeches we're starting now, you can't understand me. We deal in two entirely different realms. What you do is what you do, what I do is what I do, and there is no meeting point between the two, is God's message to Job. So don't, you know, there will... I'm communicating with you for the sake of explaining why I will not communicate with you. That's effectively the message of the speech. We're going to see it today, I hope. And then the conclusion, though, afterwards, after God has said, yeah, there's no relationship. I should say, there's no communication. The conclusion is he gives Job a gift, which, as we'll see, is not meant to make him whole. This is not meant to say, all those bad things I did to you in the beginning, now they're wonderful. It's not about that. Rather, it's a demonstration that God values him. It's a demonstration that he hasn't been cast away. Even if there will be no communication, nonetheless, there he is, to some extent, some kind of a relationship. It's just not the one that you want. That's the idea. And I think it's particularly important to stress that as we start this speech, and we only read the first three verses of it last week, because I got caught up in what I'm not going to get caught up in this week, because there are two different questions you can ask about this. One question is, what's going on? And the second question is, do I like it? And I got caught up in the latter one, and I'm not making that mistake again. But in terms of what's going on, what it means is that this speech here that God is going to give to Job, and he's going to ask him, where were you when I did this, and do you understand that, and so forth, is not a speech of, I, God, am wonderful. Rather, it's who are you, Job, and what do you know about any of this? And you're going to see that very clearly come through, particularly in the latter half of this speech, as you get into the 39th chapter, but even in the 38th. Susan?
But whenever we've had prophets or whatever, you know that they have a dream or whatever. Here God comes, and there's no preface as to how the Job and the visitors hear and view God.
Sure there is. That was the key word that we did last week, the word from the whirlwind.
From the whirlwind. So they sort of heard this.
The whirlwind is what obscures God. In other words, it is an obscured vision. It is a frightening vision.
But there's a voice coming from it?
Yeah, precisely.
Okay.
You got it right there.
Let's
say Rita and then Karen.
So we conclude that God values Job. Do we also conclude that he loves Job?
Nope.
Okay.
Love is not a word in this book.
Okay.
It's simply not in the vocabulary of the book.
Is it in our vocabulary up to this point at all?
In this book?
Talk about it?
In Job?
No.
Anywhere. Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Shir Hashirim, Song of Songs, is filled with that. That's my point.
Okay,
these are two songs. Okay, how
one.
About the Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, right? In the Shema, you shall love Hashem, your God.
You shall. Not the opposite.
No, you find that as well. You find God loving the human being as well. You find, for example, at Hashem Ha'amarta Hayom, you have selected God as yours today, Vashem Ha'amircha Hayom, and God has selected you today. The question is, do you find the word Ahava, and that I'm not sure of. That I'm not sure of. That I'd have to look for. But you find the idea of selection, and only you have I selected from all of the nations.
Yeah, that's right. But
and
that's
you are my child.
But that's not the same thing.
Correct. Sorry? Forgot, right, that's true. Moshe points out that Hashem, your God, has loved you. That's a biblical verse, yes. Sorry, Karen, you were going to...
Yeah, no, I just simply... So I wasn't here, and I listened to half of this, but it was a lot of other people speaking last week.
Yeah.
Okay, so... No, that's no problem. But, so when you say God's speaking...
Yeah.
And you say it's true out of the world... So can you just tell me how is God speaking?
It's God generating sound. That's the answer. Maimonides Rambam discusses this, as does the Kuzari. If God doesn't have a body, how does God speak? And the general assumption is that it means that there is a creation of sound. And in the sense that when I speak, my vocal cords are vibrating the air, and that comes to your ears and so forth. So it could be God is creating this physical sound, this sound waves, or that he's planting something in their head, either way. As the Kuzari, I think, writes, I can't really tell you how it happened. I can only tell you how it could have happened.
So it could be physical or it could not be physical.
Correct. But the image of the Sa'ara, the image of the whirlwind, is this powerful image, and I'm going to come back to, as I said that I would, but at the end of this round, at the end of chapter 39, this image of God speaking from the whirlwind and Elijah, where God says, I'm not in the whirlwind. So that's still on the agenda. But what I really want to do is start this chapter. Because, I'm sorry, Rita, I apologize. Last time we got dragged so far afield, and my schedule really is to complete this book on that...
I'll be wild.
Okay, great. On Tuesday, June 7th, and then, God willing, we'll have a Siyum here on Tuesday, June 14th. That's the goal. Yes? Am I what? No, just audio. Yeah. Okay, so we are on Chapter 38, Sentence 4. It is page 1671. God has challenged Job already, and he says to him now, Eifo ha'isa b'yasdi aret. And as I said last week, I'm not going to be going into most of these sentences in any great depth, because otherwise we really won't finish this year. But we'll do some depth. Eifo ha'isa b'yasdi aret. Where were you when I founded the land? Hageid im yadata vina. Speak up if you have any understanding. The first image of three in the speech that we're going to get here, in the overall speeches of God, is the image of the universe as a whole. And he says, where were you when I established the world? Misam mimadeha, kiseida. Who placed the mimadim? Mimadim are boundaries or dimensions. Who placed the dimensions? Who established the boundaries? Do you know? Ominata lehakav. Who was it who set up the kav? The kav is the plumb line. When you construct like a wall and you want to make sure everything is going to be straight, you use a plumb line. That's what the kav is. Literally, kav we translate as a line. Right, Mark Twain. Very good. Samuel Clemens. Alma adanel hatba'u. On what were its adanim? Adanim are? Adanim are bases like sockets. In the Mishkan, when they had the boards were based in Adanim. It's the socket at the bottom that forms the foundation. Alma adanel hatba'u. On what were those adanim, these sockets, established? Omi yara evan pinasa. Who was it who set up, or threw down, you could read, the stone that was its cornerstone? Biran yachad koch vevoker, when the stars of the morning all sang it together. Vayariu kol b'nei Elokim, and all of the b'nei Elokim, which is a very loaded phrase in this book. Who are the b'nei Elokim in this book? You got to have a memory for this one. Go back 59 weeks. They were? Those are the angels who God is conferring with in the first place when the Satan comes in and makes trouble. He says, at that time, when they all trumpeted, where were you? Note, a couple of notes. First of all, God at this point does not talk at all about himself. The emphasis is, Job, what do you know of these things? This isn't your realm, Job. You want to know why I do things and how the universe runs. You're way out of your league. There's no communication possible. I also want to note that for those who argued, and I sort of dropped this view along the way because I found it made things more complex than they needed to be, and I didn't find it consistent with the text. But for those who argued that Job was saying that God outsourced the running of the universe, right? Remember, we had two tracks. One track was that he believes there's just no justice, and the other that God assigned it to the stars. So for those who take the view, which I think we saw in Ralbag, somewhat in Mitzudat David, those who take the view that Job says God outsourced the universe, the running of the universe, to the stars, so God says, the stars sing to me. Right? Meaning, I control the stars. You can't say, well, the stars are running the show. The stars are mine. They sang to me from the beginning. Another note. Any Sfardim? We have any Sfardim? There's a beautiful song which is found more among the Sfardim called Odeh Lakel. It's in Yeshiva. They sang it in Shavuos morning before starting Shacharis. After everyone's been learning all night, they sing this song called Odeh Lakel. It's a beautiful song. So one of the lines in the chorus, they repeat, is Biron Yachad Koch Veboker, when the stars of morning sing all together. And of course, it's from Job. Who would know? But that's where it's from. It's from the song was written in 16th century North Africa by Rabbi Shimon Kosson. In any case, God says to him, "Where were you when the world was established? And now, where were you when the sea was established?" Pasuk Chet, sentence 8. Vayasech b'dolasayim yam b'gicho me'rechem yitzei. Do you know who it was I mean, he asked who was it who set up the dimensions of the earth and so on. Now he asks, who was it who placed doors for the sea? Bigicho merechem yetzei, when it burst forth from the womb. Vayasech, right? What word is vayasech like? What is vayasech?
Continue.
No. Not to pour. Nope. Sukkah. A sukkah, a shelter. Tzrach, also correct. Vayasech b'dlasayim yam. He set up doors, boundaries for the sea. And then he writes, this is a very funny image, in sentence 9, Bisumi anan levusha, when I placed, and God does refer to his own actions here and there here, Bisumi anan levusha, when I made the cloud its garb, va'arafel chatulato, and the fog, the cloud, its chitulim. What are chitulim?
Diapers.
When I diapered the sea. Right? That fits. It's consistent because in sentence 8, he had the sea bursting forth from the womb. The sea is a baby. Right? So it emerges from the womb, and now it needs diapers. So that's the image. Vayishbor alav. Vayishbor alav chuki. And I literally broke upon it my boundary, meaning I imposed a wall. Va'asim b'riach udlasayim. I put in a bolt, I put in doors. Va'omar, and I declared, ad po sabo v'lo sosif. You get to go to here and no further. Ufo yashis b'ga'on galecha. And here, your waves will be established with all of their strength. This is your boundary. This is your limit. And then he says, still on this universe theme, from Pasuk Yud Bet to Tedvav, from sentence 12 to sentence 15, he says, Hamiyamecha tzivisa boker. Did you, in all your days, ever command the morning? This is a tough word. Yidata hashachar mikomo. The hay is shifted to the end of yidata, but it should be read with the word after it. Yidata hashachar mikomo. Did you ever tell the morning where it should be? Did you ever command the morning? Did you ever tell the morning where it should be? Reminiscent of Bereshit, right? In creation, where it says that God identifies the night, and he says, okay, the darkness, and you'll be at night. He identifies the light and says, you'll be during the day. So did you ever, you know, tell everything where its place ought to be? Le'echoz b'chanfos ha'aretz. To grip the corners of the earth. V'na'aru risha'im mimena. And the wicked will be shaken off of it. That's a very interesting image.
What's it?
Sorry?
What's it?
The land. To hold the corners of the earth, and the wicked will be shaken off of it, off of the earth. Sorry?
The flood.
That's the flood? Could be. Could well be. Why does that sentence strike us as strange? What did it introduce here that wasn't in the previous 12 sentences?
Punishment,
judgment, involvement with human beings. Correct. There were no people to this point. This is a very odd sentence, but it sounds like what he's saying is not only do I create a day, but I create a day of judgment. I suspect that what he's doing is conveying a message to Job. The message is the one who creates the day is the one who creates the day of judgment. You wanted to know when are the wicked going to be punished and good things happening for the righteous. You wanted to know when all of that is going to be. When you're the one to declare the day, you're the one to declare when judgment should happen. The two go hand in hand. Now, there's something funny about that word. How do they do it in... How do they present the word Rishaim in here?
The ayin is raised.
Yeah, they have the raised ayin. So I want to come back to that at the end of this speech. I want to talk a little bit about that raised ayin. It's a very funny thing. It's going to come up a second time shortly. Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14. This is a very hard sentence, which we're also going to have to come back to at the end. Tishapech kechomer chosam. That's a very hard sentence. The Art Scroll renders it here as talking about the earth. as it changes itself, as a seal does to clay, as people come into being like the earth's garment. That is almost unintelligible. Someone a little sarcastic. I had posted a thought on this Shirashirim and Eov thing on my blog online, and someone commented that now we just have to wait for Art Scroll to come out with a translation of Job that doesn't resemble its words in the same way that their translation of Shirashirim doesn't resemble it. So I said to him, frankly, no translation of Job resembles its words anyway. It's just the way it is. But Tisapech Kechomer Chosam is a very hard phrase to work with. You could read it either as saying that the earth is altered in the way that clay is altered by the seal. When you stamp something with a seal, so that changes the clay, and then it stands like a garment. However, it could also be taken as referring to the wicked person who we just described, and he will be altered like the earth with the seal. And there's yet another way to read it, which I'm going to bring at the end of this speech. But however you read this sentence, fundamentally what it is saying is that the very materials that make up the heavens and the earth are immutable. They're changeable at God's hand. And he forms it, and he extends it, and he puts in boundaries, and he shapes it. V'imana, and then the last sentence of this section, V'imana merisha'im oram, their light bill will be withheld from the wicked. Uzro'a rama tishaver, and the raised arm will be broken. There's also another way to read this sentence that ties it into reincarnation, just for fun. Yeah, Susan.
If you take verse 14, all things take care of all the different centuries of change, like the Iron Age, the Stone Age.
Why?
Well, because he says he isn't, from what you said, he says he is in control and he makes changes at his whim.
Right.
So how else would all of what we've read before coincide, like, with actual history or fact? Mm-hmm. And this verse seems to be the one point
where he's going to address history, essentially.
Yes.
Right, he's gone from the personal to the... but not just national, but
natural.
But his... Right. It's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I hear. Thank you. So, and that goes actually back to the point that we made earlier on when we noted that Elihu speaks of the political, where Job kept speaking about the personal. So we did have that there. Okay. So God says to him, first of all, in terms of the running of the universe, you need a little bit of an education because you weren't involved. You don't have the most basic understanding of what this world is. In order to have a conversation about it, you need to know what you're talking about, which, you know, isn't necessarily required. But it's a good thing to have. So he shifts gears now to talk about not creation of the universe, but knowledge of the physical world in general. He's going to talk about the depth of the world and the breadth of the world. Depth and breadth. There you go. Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16. Havasa ad Nivcheyam. Tell me, have you entered ever Nivcheyam? What is Navoch? Right, Navoch usually refers to being very confused, upset, right? Not really comprehending, more nevuchim, right? The guide of the perplexed. So what are Nivcheyam? So that Mikra suggests that it refers to whirlpools, which is nice, like whirlwind, whirlpool. What does the Art Scroll do here? Hidden depths. All right. I mean, that which cannot be comprehended, effectively.
Springs.
I think that's like the whirlpool idea. You know, turmoil kind of an image. Okay. Uvecheker tahom his halachta. Have you ever walked along the investigation of the depths? Now remember what tahom has been before. Tahom throughout this book was the place of the dead. Right, we talk about the Rifa'im being beneath the Tahom, the ghosts and spirits being below. Well, now he says, Haniglu lecha sharei maves, the gates of death, they're revealed to you. Visharei tzalmaves tireh, do you see the gates of tzalmaves, is this odd place of death, which we've talked about off and on through the book. Hisbonanta ad rachve aretz. Did you contemplate the breadth of the land? So he's gone from the depth to the breadth. Have you contemplated the breadth of the land? Hagid im yadata kula. Tell me if you know it. Know all of it. Eze haderech yishkan or. Where is the path where light will reside? Where is it that light lives? V'choshech eze mikomo. Where is the place of darkness? Kisik, meaning not the place that is light, or the place that is dark, but the home of light, and the home of darkness. Where is the point of origin of energy? Where is the point of origin of, I don't know if choshech should be rendered as absence of energy or as something else entirely. It's often viewed as being substantive. Kisikachenu el gvulo. You're going to take it to its boundary. V'chisavin nesivos beso. You're going to understand the paths of its home. Yadata ki az tivaled. Umispar yamecha rabim. This is another sentence that's very hard to render. I'm going to take it a certain way. There are a lot of ways you could translate this. But he says, do you know? Because you were born back then. Umispar yamecha rabim, and you just lived a really long time? Were you around back then, Job? Havasa el otzros shalek. Did you come to the storehouses of snow? The otzros barad tiret. Did you see the places where the barad, the hail, is stored? Asher chasachti le'es tsar, which I have saved for a time of war. Liom krav u'milchama, for a day of battle. Eze haderech yechalek or. Where is the path where light will split? Yafet kadim aleyaretz, to be scattered across the land. This image of the path of light showing up again. So, not only where were you when everything was created, did you understand creation, but do you understand the world that's around you now? Where light begins, where darkness is, where the hail and the precipitation is. This universe is incomprehensible to you, Job. But he's not even close to being done. He then moves on to talk about power over the storm. And remember that Elihu liked the storm image. This is one of those sections that makes it look like Elihu is there to set up the speeches from God. So the whole rest of this chapter, not the whole rest of this chapter, but most of the rest of this chapter is going to be about power over the storm. And he says to him, Mi filag, sentence 25, Mi filag la shetef te'ala v'derech la chaziz kolot. He says, who was it who carved a path for the shetef? Shetef is the flood. Who is it who made a path for chaziz kolot? Chaziz kolot is a funny phrase. Chaziz is usually a cloud. So what's a chaziz kolot?
He said thunder.
A thunder cloud, right? A cloud of sounds. Who is it who set up a path for the thundercloud? Lamtir al eretz lo ish. This is, to me, is an important phrase. Lamtir al eretz lo ish, to bring rain on a place where there is no one, no human being. Midbar lo adam bo, to a wilderness which doesn't have a human being there. Lahasbia shoah shoah. To say to the place that is entirely desolate, which is a phrase we saw back in Paraklamet in chapter 30, this Shoah u'mishoah, u'latzmiach mitzo desha, as well as to bring forth grass in this place that has no human beings. And now I'm going to pause with that for a second, just to the last few sentences. God says, who made a path for the flood? Who made a path for the thunderclouds? So in source number 2, I brought you from the Talmud, they bring this as part of the discussion about Job's statement that maybe God got him confused. Remember, we saw that line where God said, in the whirlwind, maybe God either struck me with the whirlwind, right? It was chapter 9, sentence 17. We talked about it last week. That the whirlwind image was something that Job had invoked, saying that God struck him with it. But we also saw in the Talmud, the way to read that as, maybe God got confused in the whirlwind. Maybe he confused me for somebody else, and Eov for Oyev, right? Job for the enemy. So the passage in the Talmud here reads it as God responding to Job and saying, I don't get confused in the whirlwind. I don't have difficulty, you know, seeing you. And so, what you see here in source number 2, Harbe tipin barasi be'avim, I created many drops in the clouds. We've read this part before, the first half of it, so I'll just skim through it, the first half. But I create many, many raindrops. Each one has a unique mold. They're not going to emerge from the same mold. If they did, they would be terribly destructive. I don't know what that means. I didn't confuse two raindrops for each other. I didn't confuse you, Job, either. And then, the part that's directly related to our sentence, Harbe kolot barati be'avim, I created many thunderclaps in the clouds. V'chokol v'chol barasi lo shmil b'fnei atzma. In each one, I gave its own path. Kedei shalo yushtei kolot yotzo mishmil achad. You can't have two thunderclaps emerge from the same path. Shel male shtei kolot yotzo mishmil achad machrivinet kol ha'olam, because they would destroy the whole world. What that means? I don't know. You think, if I don't get confused between the thunderclaps, you think I get confused between you and somebody else? I'm okay, Job. I get it. I know who you are, and that's not why this is happening. Yes?
I'm just wondering that phrase, maybe if I wanted to, I could confuse. I could destroy the whole world.
That's interesting. I don't think that's the way the Talmud is saying that, although I think that it is a message of the chapter. Meaning, I think the chapter is underscoring not only the difference between what God knows and what Job knows, but I think it is also underscoring the fact that there's an awful lot of destructive power there. If he really wanted to do a number on the world, he could. But I think what the Talmud is trying to do is it's giving a different gloss on this whole chapter. Because fundamentally, everyone who reads this, including some of the people here who have talked to me about this chapter, everyone is fundamentally bothered with, why is God spending his time with this speech to Job? If you're going to finally talk to him, why is this what you have to say? And so what the Talmud is doing is it's saying, God is trying to explain, no, I'm not confused. Yes, I'm running the world. And no, you're not going to understand it. Which is different from what I've been presenting as the fundamental message, which is, Job, there can be no communication because we operate on different playing fields. It's not the same, that's not the same thing. But what the Talmud is saying is that God is saying to Job, I didn't get confused. This is happening for a reason, and it's my reason, and that's just the way it is. The image, though, of causing a storm and creating grass on a place where there are no people. Why do you create rain and grass in a place where there are no people? Why do that? Yeah. Yeah, basically, that's my question. Why are you creating rain in a place where there are no people? Right, so one way to look at it would be, hey, maybe he's making a land available for people in the future. I think that's a touch too optimistic for this chapter. You know? What else?
Is there any possibility that all this is a metaphor for Job?
Meaning?
That the grass is that, Job, you have potential.
Oh, so he's saying to Job... Well, so he's saying, I create rain that enables growth, and Job, even though you've been destroyed, there's a possibility of growth for you. But that wouldn't fit beyond these couple of sentences. In other words, the whole rest of this chapter couldn't be read that way. So it's a nice idea. I just, again, feel like it doesn't really fit what he's doing here overall. We did see in the previous section, in the previous chapter, that God can punish people for wrongdoing by steering blessing away from them. In other words, I promised I was going to bring rain, but I didn't say where I was going to bring it. So if you're not worthy, I'm just going to send it off somewhere where you're not going to benefit. You could say that, but I think actually the Da'at Mikra's point on this is correct. The Da'at Mikra reads it and says, it's saying that you have to get over yourself, Job, because the universe isn't all about you. You weren't there when I created it. You don't understand the way it works. You haven't seen its great breadth. You haven't seen its great depth. And there are places where I bring life, and it has nothing to do with you or your entire species. Because the universe isn't about you, Job. And, you know, it's an important message. I think I mentioned it in a previous class, this issue of anthropocentricity, the question of whether the universe is created for human beings. Right, ring the bell? I think? Where Rasajagon is of the belief, as many are, that no, we are the point of existence. God wanted there to be entities with free will, that's us, and he created everything in order to play out what will happen when there is a physical being who has the ability to choose. But Rambam Maimonides says, you got to be kidding me. That's not why God created the world. There may be a benefit, you know, that's our mission, but there's a whole lot that has nothing to do with us. And God says here, Job, not only do you not comprehend it, not only have you not seen it, but you're not even necessarily the central actor on the stage. That's Don Mikra's take on this, and I think there's a lot to be said for it, particularly because it's going to fit really, really well with chapter 39. Which we are heading towards momentarily. But I think it's going to fit really, really well with chapter 39. Newsom points out one other point that I wanted to show you here. I mentioned that this phrase, Shoah u'mishoah, the place that is fully desolate, right, in sentence 27, right? That same phrase was used by Job back in chapter 30. When Job was describing how he had been chased out and he was caused to suffer, in chapter 30, sentence 3, he describes how the people he had once looked down on, the people who whose fathers he had rejected, they are the ones who are now mocking him. And there he talked about them as being in the place of Emesh Shoah u'mishoah, the place of darkness and desolation. So Job, Newsom points out, if we take a look at source number 3, and I brought it for you from Newsom, I thought it was brilliant. She says, the one point at which their geographies overlap, meaning the geography of what God describes and the geography of what Job describes, is in the reference to the waste and desolate land. Yet nothing underscores the incommensurate nature of their perceptions more than their construals of this common space. Meaning, in fewer syllables, Job sees this place and says, this is a ruin. There's no life here. It's a desolate, dark place, and the people who live there are unworthy people. What does God see when he looks at this place? What does God see in sentence 27 in our chapter? He sends rain and he creates grass and life. Job sees ruin. God sees a cradle for life. Not just potential, but that which he's going to actually act on and produce. And you think about it, I mean, you know, Job is, not without reason, you know, very dark in the whole book, and not without reason. He's never once spoken about bringing life. It's an entirely different way of looking at destruction. So that's what Newsom does here. I thought that was an interesting point. So again, we're still in this section in which God is describing power over the storm, and he talks about sending rain to the place that is desolate. And then in sentence 28, so we're on page 1671. I realize I'm going quickly, but I hope it's not too quickly. All right, okay. Hayesh lamatar av. Is there a source for the rain? Av does not have to mean father. Av means source. Is there a source, although it would fit, I mean, we have the womb for the sea, so I guess there could be a father for the rain. Is there a source for the rain? O mi holid egle tal. Who is it who birthed egle tal? Egle tal are, Rashi says, either waves of dew or receptacles for dew. Interestingly, for those who learn the laws of Shabbos, there's a key work on the 39 Malachot of Shabbat called Eglei Tal, by Rav Borenstein, who his son, I think, was the Shem Mishmuel. He himself wrote the Avnei Nezer in the 19th century. So he makes a play on words. Tal, right, is do, but it's 39. So the 39 Malachot of Shabbat. So he names his book on the laws of Shabbos, Eglei Tal, pulling a phrase from Ehud, for goodness sake. People look at the book and say, where'd this name come from? Oh, Job. The Mibeten mi yatsa hakarach, continuing with this image of birthing, from the belly of whom did the frost or the ice emerge? Ukfor shamayim mi yalado, who birthed the frost of the heavens? Ka'even mayim yischaba'u, they hide. The water hides like stone, meaning it hides in solid form, it freezes. Ufnei sahom yislakadu, and the face of the depths of the water is caught, meaning, again, freezing. And then God says to him, who controls the storm? Hasik hasher ma danot kima, o moshchot ksil tefateach. Can you tie up, it's to control, the chains of kima? Kima is the Pleiades. That's the way it's usually rendered. That's, I assume, what they do here. Yeah, the Pleiades. O moshchot ksil tefateach. Can you open the ropes of, or the reins of ksil, which is usually rendered as, yeah, they do it here, Orion. Which you may recall, because we saw this much earlier in the book, and those who were here when we did the Medrash on Parshas Noach, we did it back then as well. These are the constellations that are supposed to bring rain. So, Hasotzi Mazaros Bi'ito, do you bring out the Mazarot, also known as Mazalot? Do you bring out the constellations at their time? The Ayish Albanea Tanchem, do you lead the Ayish over her son? So, Ayish is usually understood as the bear, and indeed I see the art scroll renders it as Ursa. Doesn't say if it's minor or major. But do you guide the constellations? And I brought you in number 4, we're not going to read through it, but just the Talmud itself speaking about the constellations and their influence on the rain. Hayadata chukos shamayim. Do you know the laws of the heavens, meaning the laws by which they function? Im tasim mishtaro ba'aretz, do you place their control, mishtaro like shoter, do you place their control over the land? Hasarim la'av kolacha v'shifas mayim techaseka. Can you raise your voice to the clouds such that you will then be covered with a downpour of rain? Hasishalach b'rakim v'yelechu. Can you send forth lightning and it's going to go? V'yomru lacha hineinu, and they'll say, here we are, we act at your bidding. Can you summon the rain and the lightning, Job? Mi shas, and here's another sentence, this is great. Mi shas batuchos chochma. Who was it who put chochma, who put wisdom into tuchot? Tuchot is an interesting word. They render it in the Da'at Mikra as either one's innards or one's kidneys. They say innards here. Okay. Who put wisdom in one's innards? O minasan lasechvi vina. Who put Bina into the Sechvi? What is a Sechvi? They translate it here as? What do they do? Heart. Mind, heart. That's, they're both the same for this purpose. What other word did you expect to see here? Rooster. There's a blessing recited every morning, right? That God put La Sechvi Vina. Put understanding into the, usually translated as, rooster. So what's going on? Clearly, heart is a lot more satisfying as a translation here. We're asking, God is asking, who created wisdom? And in fact, Ibn Ezra, Ralbag, Radak on Tehillim, all take this as heart. It's saying, who put wisdom into the human heart? And yet, people do say, rooster, like in that morning blessing. So, if we take a look at source number 5, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish reported the following, Keshalachti l'tchum Kan Nishraya, when I went to the boundary of Kan Nishraya, which itself is funny here, because a Kan, or a cane, is a nest, Nishraya are vultures. We render it as eagles, but we'll talk about that another time. But I went to this place, the nest of the Nisharim, and Hayukoran Lakala Ninfi, they use the term Ninfi to refer to a bride. Ulatarnigol Sechvi. And they called a rooster Sechvi. So in other words, there were people who used this term for the rooster. And in fact, the Tur, Rabbi Yaakov Bala Turin, a central authority in the chain of Jewish law, says that when we say this blessing that God puts puts intellect into the sechvi, it's because roosters have the understanding that enables them to tell when day is arriving. So therefore we borrow a term which naturally refers to the heart, and we apply it for the rooster as well. Of course, anybody who has ever lived near a chicken farm knows that roosters crow at all hours. Nonetheless, that's what we say, that the roosters know. Maybe somewhere there's a rooster that only crows when it's close to morning. But that's where this comes from, and yes, that's the language of the brach, the language of the blessing comes from, buried in Job chapter 38. Excellent. Mi saper shchakim bechokhmah. The theme here is creating understanding. So, who is it who will yisaper shechakim? That's another word that's hard to render, yisaper. Ibn Ezra says it's to set up the heavens like sapphire, like sapir. So who is it who will set up the heavens like sapphire? Mitzvah David, he makes the heavens clear like sapphire. Rashi says it's to command the heavens, lisaper, as in to command. All sorts of different ways you could explain it. I assume the article takes Rashi, because it usually does. Glisten? Oh, okay, so then they're not. They're taking Mitzvah David. Okay. V'nivlei shamayim mi yashkiv. Who is it who settles Nivlei Shamayim, which the Da Mikra renders as the Nodot Shamayim, the barrels of the heavens, the stores of the rain. Bitseket afar lamutzak uregavim yidubaku. The last sentence in this part. The hardening of the earth to create, the hardening of the dirt to create a solid earth, making the clods of earth stick together. That concludes the first part of the first speech. That's part one. In which he says to Job, fundamentally, this can be summed up in one sentence, you and I are operating on different wavelengths, you want to communicate with me, but my thoughts are of the heavens and the earth, creation, governing everything far beyond the realm of man, and your focus is yourself, and that's all you have ever experienced, and it's all you really know, and therefore there can be no real communication. That's part one. Part two of this speech is fantastic.
Is that meant to be a criticism?
I don't think so. I mean, it ends up being a criticism because the result is, therefore, all of your demands are foolish. So in that sense, it's a criticism. But I think it's a statement of fact of there can be no communication. That's just not possible. You want to know why I don't talk to human beings? It's because they bore me. No, you want to know why I don't talk to human beings? It's because there's no frame of reference. They can't understand what I would talk about. There's nothing to speak about.
There's no opportunity because it's all rhetorical questions.
Well, no, there is an opportunity. It's coming at the end of 39.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. No, don't worry. There will be an opportunity, but you'll see what Job makes of it. So the second part of this speech is beautiful. I mean, I like the first part also, frankly. If you read it without pausing between every line to explain things, it really flows nicely. But the second image that he's going to use is the image of the beasts of the wild. And again, the Talmud said before that it was already reading this as about God's capacity, so the Talmud reads this section as, and not really the Talmud, the commentators read the section as about how much more God can do than we can do. That's sort of a classic way to look at it. But again, I have a different way to look at this, going along with the theme that I developed already from Shir HaShirim and from Song of Songs. It's about the difference between God's world and our world. And here I'm going to co-opt a thought of Newsom and use it to my own end. Take a look at number 6, please, on the sheet. Because I think what she says accentuates that very well. She points out that we think of the wild very differently than they did. In our day, wild creatures tend to be thought of as endangered species. The encroachment of urbanization, the tearing down of the forests, driving out the animals from their habitats. It's sort of like these animals are vulnerable and we have to protect them. But if you go back to Job's time, what is the wild? What is the world of the wild ox, the world of the lion? It's a threat. It's frightening. Let's take a look at what she says in number 6. She compares what Job does, what God does in Job here, and Tehillim Kuf Dalet, Psalm 104, which you're familiar with perhaps as Barchi Nafshi. That psalm talks about the beauty of creation and all that God has created and the role of man within that. So look what she says. It is possible, as Psalm 104 attests, to create out of this material a vision of the world as a harmonious place in which the spheres of the human and the animal coexist as complementary creations of God. But that is not what the divine speeches are about. Here, the suppression of descriptions of human activity, the explicit opposition between the animals and human purposes, and repeated references to God's provision for these creatures, the wild creatures, destabilizes the customary binary oppositions of order in the chaotic culture and nature, blessed and God forsaken.
What does that mean?
One more sentence. More disturbingly, it seems to associate God in a positive fashion with these creatures of the fearful beyond. Meaning, normally, we envision the world as being orderly and civilized on the one part, and chaotic and destructive on the other part, and God is in the order side along with the human being. But what you're going to see here is a list of wild creatures, and God is with them. God supports them. God nourishes them. He takes care of their young. He looks after them. God's on the wild side of the universe, not on the human side of the universe. That's what Newsom sees within this, and I think it's consistent with what I'm trying to say about this in general. Job, your world is entirely different from my world. And all the things that human beings talk about as things that they have brought into the world, that's what I do with the wild. So if you flip your sheet to number 7, I gave you an outline of this speech and the things that God speaks of. God speaks of how he provides food for the lion and the ravens. We pride ourselves on feeding the domesticated animals. Who's feeding those beasts? I do. And if you humans weren't here, I'd feed these animals also. You pride yourself on having domesticated sheep and goats such that you're able to breed their young and produce what you want. Think Jacob, right? The whole story with the sheep. Who takes care of breeding the wild goat? That will be me. And if you humans weren't around, I'd do it for the sheep also. You describe how you have tamed the donkey and you've tamed the ox. Well, what about the wild donkey? The wild ox, the ostrich, is going to make a showing here again. The war horse, you talk about how you have horses that you can take into battle, and they're going to fight for you. I invented the prowess of the horse in the wild. Wild horses have that independent of human beings. And then he's going to have a really stark image at the end with the hawk and the vulture, but I don't want to blow the ending. Yes?
This seems to go back to also the part where he talked about why he created the areas where no man lives, yet there's...
Exactly.
It's the same thing.
Exactly, and that was why I said when we read that, I liked what Don Mikra had to say, that he's saying our worlds are different, Job. The world, I bring rain on the place of desolation, right? I bring rain there, and it's not about human beings. There are no human beings there. It has its own reason for existing. And you, Job, and your species aren't really necessary for it. So exactly, I think that it is connected back to that thought. Good. So we're not going to finish this chapter, but at least we can start it. Rita.
So is God saying without human beings, the world would still exist?
Yes. Uh-huh. And not only exist, but have purpose.
And have purpose.
Yep. Human beings, it was nice having you, you know. Yes, Sharon, and then...
God saying, what do I need?
In a way,
like,
yeah.
I run the world, I know what I'm doing.
Well, I don't think he crosses the line into insulting Job that way and saying, what do I need you for? But I think he's sort of challenging Job to assess anew his place in the world. Which, ironically, come to think of it, feeds into one thing that Job had said earlier in the book. One of Job's complaints was, I'm so insignificant, why are you bothering to spend time hurting me? Truth is, he could respond to God and say, that's my point. Janine?
Well, I was just wondering, could it be read
in
an entirely different way, that what you consider chaos and wilderness, I'm involved in making this whole thing work and taking charge of everything. And if you think that in this chaos and wilderness I'm directing things, then certainly I'm directing your life.
100%. You could completely read it that way, and that would be consistent with the overall view that this is a statement to Job that I know what I'm doing, more or less.
As opposed to saying, you know,
that there's no one. Right.
It's maybe more encouraging.
Could be. I'm not sure I need to feel that this is an encouraging message here at all. Susan.
If God says that there is a purpose to the world without us, why does he tell us what it is?
Why does he not tell us what the purpose would be?
Okay, the article said to think that the world needs us.
Yeah.
And God's saying it doesn't. But when I look at the world, like, is he saying that the purpose of the world is just to have animals or existence?
Oh, he's not telling us what it's there for.
That's right.
Because it's, one thing that I think he has clearly established here is we're operating on different wavelengths. There's nothing within the human experience that will prepare it for any comprehension of what this would be worth. It would be like if you had a human being, just to bring it to a level that I can comprehend, if you had a human being who went around doing things that totally didn't fit and didn't make any sense, and one day you went up to him and asked him, why did you do that? You know, he throws out his food instead of eating it. He sleeps on the roof. He, I don't know what, you know, come up with whatever odd behaviors you want. And one day I were to ask him, why do you do that? And he says, because the sky is blue. That sentence may have meaning to him, but it sure doesn't have meaning to me. And that's what God is saying. We're in two different realms. And so I'm not going to, there's no point in even discussing why. It's just not something that can be communicated in your vocabulary. Yeah?
Isn't he beating the openness over the head? I mean, what?
Let me ask you a question. Job had at least 10 speeches in this book. God gets 2. You know, I mean, I will not question the fact that it's repetitive.
He's not speaking to God. He's speaking to the listeners.
Do you think so? I think he's talking to God. I think so. All right, we're going to have to pick up with this next time. One thing I do want to call your attention to.